Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Pulley.
And I'm Tom Costura.
And this weekly segment is an interesting one because we're going to cover our second quarterly report for 2026, as well as talk about a couple stories, tactics, and insights that may matter to threat hunters most with this week, July 6, 2026. So, Tom, why don't you kick it off with the quarterly report? What were some of the things based on the other things we talked about?
Yeah, so, you know, just kind of bringing back, we, you know, the podcast here, we talk about so many articles. So each quarter we've been putting out a threat report to summarize, you know, the items that we brought to the table throughout the show and the live shows and anything that occurred in those given quarters, really just to try to drive together the points we made and the ideas behind what we've seen from like trending analysis or very specific types of behaviors or attacks, to really kind of like put that whole quarter together and say, hey, these are kind of key things that we think you should focus on or consider because they're the most loud, they're the most obvious, or they might have a peg in prioritization. So, you know, kind of with that, you know, let's walk through some of the stuff that we've seen this quarter, Scott. So, you know, a couple, you know, just high level bullets and some of the kind of stats that we've seen throughout the last quarter. We covered down on 18 different specific intel articles that we reported on. Within those articles, 23 different threat actors, 95 different MITRE techniques covered down on various artifacts, industry sources. There was a lot of depth into all the stuff once you kind of start putting it together. Really, some of the strategic themes is which, you know, where I'm going to really kind of dive into, Scott, to start. I'm going to work a little backwards through the report. So sorry. Some of the heavy hitting topics we've seen, supply chain focus continuing. It's we're going to keep talking about it. I feel like we're probably not going to have a show for the rest of the year that we don't speak on something supply chain because there's just so much and it's ramping up. You know, kind of leading in what, you know, some of the big things, some of the big campaigns we've seen in the last quarter. You had the stuff early in the year with the Team PCP, you know, mini Shy Halud, some of that stuff. But what we've seen in the last quarter are some evolutions to some of those techniques. You've seen the Miasma campaign, the Hades campaigns, and a bunch of various other ones that we had spoke on that were supply chain area focused, using some of those techniques that were replicated. Or you see groups like Team PCP using, you see in the traditional Shy Halud campaigns earlier or back end of last year. A lot of supply chain stuff this quarter, man. What stood out to you the most when we were going through all those different supply chain hits?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where one, the attack surface is rich. When you think about all the different libraries that exist within the Python, the Node workspace, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot there, right? People, I don't think, realize how big that attack surface generally is. And then there's been a lot more attacks that deal with actual compromised credentials, where there's info stealers stealing valid credentials, and that's kind of how people are getting in. And in that aspect, some of these repositories where these supply chain things exist, if the creds contain creds that get you into some of these repos and things, it's just another easy vector where you can kind of attack something that's not necessarily housed within an organization. Just something the organization is responsible for. So there's a lot of ways to kind of get at that attack surface. You know, it's crazy. I mean, you think about this number of libraries. There's so many libraries and things that are used that aren't even like often overly maintained. They just do simple things, but because they're so simple and work the first time, they don't get updated or edited. So there's probably a lot of less oversight or visibility for the people that created those as well, trying to keep up on it. So I think it's kind of a multi variable. I don't know what the word I'm looking for. There's like a multifaceted issue as to why I think it's a great attack surface, and there's been a lot of success going after it from the and it's probably one of the best impactful attack services too, because if people aren't paying attention, you're able to do a lot having someone else run your own code and potentially go undetected because of that. Because if it's built into a product and there are security products that are warning about it, there's a good chance people will think, well, that's our tool or that's our stuff or our trusted, you know, tool that we've been using. It's just a false positive out of the gate. So A lot of angles there that make that kind of a pressing issue, I think. So we got it for us next.
Oh, just a mute button I couldn't find. Apologies, Scott. Or, you know, out of exactly to what you're saying, but out of the supply chain kind of the continuous trend of that, there are a couple things that really stand out, and it aligns to 2 points that we make in the report. Because in our report, we really try to give those high-level trend pieces that we see, but we'll also give you stuff that you can take and operationalize, right? So we'll include some ideas for going after hunts. Two things that I think are worth pointing out, even though we are going to continue to talk about them, but I will not stop being quiet about this because I'm just really passionate about seeing this trend. Two different, you know, a similar technique, two different kind of directions is it's derived from a lot of the stuff we've seen with the supply chain attacks, but we're also seeing it overlap as the year progresses into other types of compromises that aren't supply chain focused. We're seeing these behaviors leveraged by, you know, APT groups, groups that are involved in various nexus groups inside of these different nation states, other actors and malwares leveraging these behaviors and with purpose, right? And those techniques I'm talking about are leveraging of Node and bun runtimes and how to leverage that post and pre-install hook to, you know, deliver and execute payloads, you know, kind of under the radar, really, you know, masquerading itself, not giving you a ton of telemetry to see what's going on in the actual action of the payload. And, you know, it's creative, it works, and it's being adopted. We also talked about a lot of changes that are trying to be made, right? So one instance is the new NPM versioning. We also talked about it's already being, you know, kind of circumvented, but these two behaviors are, you know, they stacked the second quarter for us. I think we talked about them a ton and we've seen them in different places. You know, what's your 2 cents on that?
On the credential piece?
The node and the bun runtime behavior.
Oh.
Using those behaviors, yeah.
Yeah, no, the node and the bun runtime, what's crazy is how people originally addressed the node issue, right? Where everyone's like, well, if node's running things, it should be suspect, but then bringing in the bun runtime to kind of sidestep a lot of that and kind of obfuscate. Because we've talked about script interpreter chaining a lot. I think it kind of falls in line with that, where if you can kind of build a chain of activity, it's harder for tool sets and defense detections to pick up on all the activity into like one specific detection. And I think that's partly why it's being set up that way. Also because it works. There's some copycat type stuff where, hey, this ran, we use the same code, we use the same approach, that kind of thing too.
Yeah, and that in the leveraging of Node and Bun, I mean, for the purposes that they're there, but the one thing that's always just kind of struck me, and I take this as a reference point to historical times and, you know, earlier years or working with younger analysts, more inexperienced analysts that were chasing down things, hunting things, reacting in a SOC environment. You see stuff that you can, you know, you see activity and then you look at it. And I think sometimes there is a nature when, especially if you're in a place where you're handling you're working through a lot of alerts or you're digging through a pretty verbose log set. And you see certain things that you're trying to, you know, pull out and say, is this abnormal? Is this normal? A lot of times you'll see stuff that looks totally normal, right? And what I mean in the context here is a lot of times we see Node not being leveraged as a tool that's already existing in the environment, but just being pulled down in its natural course. So from, you know, more of a novice analyst side, maybe, or in an environment that doesn't know itself well enough, you might see that and kind of like look past it because you're like, oh, that's Node.js. That's, you know, that's legit. But this is actually being pulled down that way by the threat actors. And then, you know, you kind of talked, you mentioned it too with the process chain piece with this is so, so interesting to me. All the different kind of random types of utilities that are being leveraged from Node or from Bun. So yeah, keep an eye on this. This is going to continue. We're going to keep talking about it. You're going to get tired of hearing me speak on it. But anytime I see it, I'm going to keep going because the trend is pointing in that direction and we're going to stay there. Okay, so one of the other kind of big things that we've seen, and Scott, I think this is actually about to start pulling itself over the cliff. We talked not so long ago, the back end of this quarter, where we talked about the Fortibleed campaign and the massive amount of credential harvesting and stealing that occurred through these different phases of this campaign. And, you know, I think we're seeing a lot of evidence from our side, intel from different places, both open source and other, where the credentials that were captured in this campaign are starting to find their ways to the market, starting to be sold. They're starting to, they're going to start to be leveraged is where I'm going with this. So while we did kind of really talk about the summary of the whole Fortibleed campaign, I think we're about to hit the windfall of it. I think it's about to come over the cliff. That's at least my assessment from what we're seeing. What did you think about this one, Scott? And how do you think people should consider this?
Yeah, so I think the interesting thing here is when we did talk about that, it was a very sophisticated operation. So it seemed much more higher than your typical criminal approach, but it didn't necessarily rely on your typical malware or info stealer approach that has been driving a lot of the market for, you know, credentials being stolen and that valid access being used. It was actually infrastructure built to go basically break into different places and then position itself in valuable locations to harvest credentials live as long as, you know, they stayed persistent in those environments. And they had many tool sets to help break in from password lists to brute forcing to other things like that. So kind of more your classic way to gain access. But then that access was really there to leverage the collection of more and more access. And so that part, I think, is very different than what we've seen with previous kind of info stealer type operations. So that in itself, I think, opens up the scale and sophistication where, you know, this could be potentially, we'll see definitely the use of the credentials taken more so, but we'll also see what other kind of campaigns we might come across like this that really kind of up the game, I should say.
Yeah, for sure. So, you know, to me, that screams, you know, if you're in an environment, you're listening, you're thinking about it, really look to, you know, build out or consider some stuff, what your visibility is around the identity centric pieces, like where, whether it be, you know, in the typical standpoint, cloud-based stuff, your 2FA things, like anything that you have credential-wise, really consider potentially doing a house cleaning, tightening up, see what you have available, maybe identify some gaps that you can improve. There's a good place for that right now because of how much was leaked just in that one effort. Mm-hmm. So yeah, definitely something to consider. You know, really, you know, one other thing that I guess I'll bring up, because there is, we did put a bunch in the report this month. Definitely want all our listeners to go out and check it out. Let us know if you have any feedback. You know, for sure, hit us up, LinkedIn. Tell us what you think, if there's anything you'd like to see more. But one other thing I'd like to bring out of this, because there's a ton here. Another kind of trend that we've seen, sort of, this is more, I think it's probably going to stay in its own little bucket. But the whole MS Nightmare thing, all the vulnerabilities that were kind of dropped out there from the Nightmare Eclipse, MS Nightmare accounts, the whole, you know, kind of chaos, if you will. I don't know what the best word for it is, between the researcher and Microsoft, some of the stuff that got dropped with POCs, you kind of started to see some of the stuff being leveraged right away. We hit a little bit of a new territory with this one, I think. And it's something that I'm personally keeping an eye on, Scott, because if we have these kind of releases in a way that's not fully, you know, partnering up with the where the vulnerability lies or the company that the vulnerability lies into, we could get in a little bit of a Wild West feel, but we had quite a few. I mean, I think if I remember right, the Nightmare Eclipse, MS Nightmare whole thing was like 5 or 6 unique vulnerabilities for Windows, and some that had been leveraged pretty quickly once they were released. But that's another one that we touch on in the report. What's your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is the where all those conversations where how does AI kind of change the game? And I would say when it comes to vulnerabilities to proof of concept to exploitation,
I think that's probably the place where we will probably start seeing a smaller window as far as when things get either discovered or disclosed, to how quickly they can be utilized. So it might not be necessarily the direct cause in this instance, but I feel like there's a trend going on with a lot of people talking about it. Even when you look at some other vulnerabilities and when they were discovered and exploited and things like that, that window is shrinking. And I kind of attribute a lot of that to the ability that AI can really help people understand vulnerabilities better, as well as potentially help develop in some ways the proof of concept or use of those vulnerabilities. That's not to say that defenders can't do similar things, right? But I just feel like that's probably what's going to change the vulnerability game in general, leading up to the rest of this year into the next.
Yeah, and I find myself a little conflicted with the whole thing, because on one hand, it's scary because of how quick it's out there. There's kind of no real, like on the defense side, there's no real working together. It's just kind of there. And then, you know, you have your threat actors or your bad actors take and leverage it pretty quickly. But on the other side, as the defender, we're getting the stuff we need to weaponize our defenses faster too. So it's like, there's almost this kind of like catch 22 with the whole thing, you know?
Yeah. Always will be.
Always will be. But yeah, I want to make sure that I leave some. There's quite a bit here. We probably could do a whole show summarizing this, but we're just going to touch on it for the first half of the show. All of our listeners, definitely go check it out. The link should be posted with the show. And yeah, let us know if you have any feedback and how you think about it. Anything else you want to speak on for the report, Scott, before we move into our article for the week?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing here is, you know, the biggest curiosity is how does the things that we say that are trending kind of compare to what people are also seeing, right? If there's other things that people see that are trending differently, it'd be good to hear, because sometimes people focus on different things and sometimes things bubble up differently. So it'd be interesting like how close or far we are from other people's mark. So that'd be really good feedback. But that's pretty much all I had to add to the report side.
Yeah, absolutely. We do take our approach. It's pretty in depth, but it's certainly not encompassing everything. So yeah, I'd love to hear what other people are doing though.
Yeah. All right. So now we'll kind of pivot into what we normally kind of talk about on our weekly basis. And that's some of the highlighted research and articles and things that come across our way that we feel the need to talk about or have something to say about. So I'll pick this one up. This is from Checkpoint. It was some of the research that they did, and it's titled Cavern Manticore Exposing Iran-Linked Modular C2 Framework. So this is interesting, right? It basically profiles the Cavern Manticore, which is an Iranian-linked threat actor, and it's using a modular .NET command and control framework, but it's primarily targeting Israeli targets, especially the government and IT sector specifically. The tradecraft really stands out because the framework is not just another backdoor. It's a modular post-exploitation platform. It actually has separate agents on different communication modules, file management modules, LDAP and AD tooling, SQL browsing, network recon, SMB brute force, and other types of password break stuff. And then SOCKS and WebSocket tunneling to assist with communication. The most important defensive takeaway is the campaign really abuses the trusted administration paths. So in the initial access piece, there are multiple intrusions that came from the abuse of existing remote management tools, RMM tools that the targets were actually using, not necessarily they were brought in like we've seen in other types of campaigns and attacks. And the observed chain included abuse of legitimate SysAid software deployment, which had a push to a DLL side loading package. So the interesting thing here is all the activity, and they even have like a menu activity of like some of the internal discovery stuff that we usually talk on. But because everything is in this .NET framework /module loaded, architecture, they don't call external binaries. They're basically pulling in their own function calls and using API calls locally because of that. So it's a lot harder to see the activity once the implants are already there, unless you have specialized tooling that can pick up on some of those things. And there's even some, when they looked at like the menu of options, there were some modules or capabilities that existed in the code but weren't present. So they believe not all modules were loaded, or like the, I guess the companion module wasn't moved into the environment. And one of them had to do with the services. So it failed to be able to like create services, stop, start services. Another dealing with stuff, and then stuff dealing with listing and killing processes. So there's, and it looks like these are all kind of considered separate modules based on the numbering scheme. That's what they assume, because there's like different series, like the 700 series is the service list series, the 600 series numbered wise is the registry based series. So you can kind of see some of the active development piece there. But the big thing here is paying attention to the DLL side loading piece. Because even though they're able to use, you know, their initial type of access by taking advantage of the RMM tools to push payloads inside, when they move the legitimate executable, which is the Winder stat executable, they also move the cavern agent, which is the uxtheme.dll, which is what's sideloaded. So it coexists in the same directory, drops at the same time, like kind of like we talked about that behavior. You have the two different writes of the two different files, executables and DLLs. And then that DLL, when the cavern agent actually runs, it then pulls in other DLLs, right? And loads those in. So I don't know. I didn't know if I saw if those other DLLs exist in the same location as that DLL. So you could potentially look for a surge of DLL writes, potentially. I don't remember if I saw that, but that's something to kind of pay attention to, because it's a lot harder. I mean, I know people use like image load and other types of things to try to see when things are loaded, but I feel like sometimes that's so cryptic, it's really hard to make good detections off of. If you have really great ways to look across your data and do some really interesting things with the data, you might be able to use that. But that's something to pay attention to. The other thing that I thought was interesting was a lot of times when you're going to analyze a DLL in a sandbox or tools, right? You usually have to run the DLL, and usually you usually like run DLL32, right? That's how you can load a DLL into memory and execute it. But you have to know the entry point or the function that is available to call to basically run from that DLL. There's either like a main function that you run that will then let the whole thing kind of run as a package, or if there's a function that's a single purpose and it's a public available function in the DLL, you can call it directly and it just does this little task and then kind of quits out, right? But you have to know those names of those functions, or a lot of times you can just call it by number because they are kind of, you know, stacked in a numbered order. And so those are called ordinals. And it's very common for malware authors to just call their stuff by ordinals. In this case, one of their ways to avoid some of that automated analysis piece is they make their key or main function ordinal number 20 versus ordinal number 1, which is very common. The thing I didn't like was I couldn't tell if the ordinal was called directly or they called the function call from the write-up that I could see, right? Well, actually, they do name the export too, but they also call the ordinal. So it could be called by name, it could be called by ordinal, but I don't think they showed the exact execution of that. Just something to pay attention to, right? But also to let you know that if you've come across a DLL and it doesn't seem to be malicious, it's going to know how it's being executed, because this could be a way to kind of bypass some of those things. So there's some, I guess, knowledge-based drops there. But yeah, so the DLL siloing is the big piece. They do a really big write-up on a lot of different capabilities to kind of show, I wouldn't say so much the complexity, but more the sophistication and modularity of this, which just shows that there could be even more capabilities being added. The only other thing I think you can potentially look for is when you're looking for like the different types of activities. This is where network activity might make sense, especially if you can tie it to a process. Because if you're seeing AD recon based on hitting certain ports or SMB brute forcing or some weird SOX 5 proxy type activity where you have like weird port traffic coming across, that actually might help you know there's something going on than just strictly just endpoint data, unless it's endpoint to network data. So yeah, that's pretty much the, I guess, the summarization that I kind of threw out there for this. But it's good to be aware of because it is a sophisticated tool. It's coming out of Iran, which people are very sensitive about based on, you know, geopolitical times. So this could be something that could show up in your environment if Iran's a group you're concerned with. Or your
tech. The things that screamed to me, there's two things. So first thing, you see the leveraging of the remote, the RMM tools, right? The remote management tools.
Yeah.
Specifically defined in here is the threat group looks for tools that exist in your environment. So it was very specific to call that out in an article.
Yeah.
And that screams to me back to the, hey, if you have these tools in your environment, RMM tools are all the creators for all of the groups, everything we see from ransomware to APT side, it doesn't matter. The leveraging of those or the taking advantage of them in your environment are pretty commonplace. So know what they're doing if you have these tools in your environment and understand how to track for tools that are like RMM tools that aren't like your approved type tool sets that are used by your, you know, your IT groups. That's the first thing that stood out to me. It was like, hey, there's a starting point. Another part that I thought was interesting, while it wasn't incredibly definitive, you could glean some ideas for some of the traditional behavioral based type hunts that you could see and things that it will do, because they did put a ton of effort in modularizing what they're trying to accomplish and with a heavy emphasis on stealth, right? They wanted it to not be seen like most, but a lot of what was done here, you're not going to see, but they do show you the full command list for the various modules and some of the things they're meant to do. So there's some information you can glean there. You're looking at a lot of discovery commands within that. You're looking at the variations of being able to add, delete, and modify registry keys. You're looking at the building, the creating services, the Let me go down. There's so much. There's a ton here. There's a lot of different things this thing's built to do that adding and removing users. There's a lot of stuff here that you can like take from a generalized behavioral concept and apply to help defend yourself with this. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, I'm always interested. There's some things where you can see the artifacts of the action being happened or the artifacts of after the action, what exists. So I think you're right. You can kind of narrow in on those things, and that would be a good approach as well. You just got to verify what it looks like if you can't see the actions.
Yep. All right. Okay. So I have one more for us this week. It's a more recent DFIR report. It's titled From Bing Search to Ransomware, Bumblebee and Adaptix C2 Deliver Akira. So kind of looking to summary what we're talking about here. So the DFIR report documented a full intrusion that began with a Bing SEO poisoning campaign and ended less than 2 days later with Akira ransomware, encrypting an enterprise environment. The attack really kind of speaks to that whole how commodity initial access malware can really kind of evolve into that enterprise-wide ransomware. Lots of steps, lots of parts to this. And it was really interesting, very fun read if you're a hunter, because there's a whole lot of stuff there to tear apart. Intrusion began when an administrator searching for a manage engine op manager downloaded a Trojanized MSI installer from a mock website. A masquerading website. Rather than exploiting a software vulnerability, the attackers exploited the user trust in the search engine here. Drives me crazy that this is still so heavy of a thing, but I digress on that point. After the initial Bumblebee infection, the operators transitioned to Adaptix C2, and they performed extensive Active Directory reconnaissance, did credential theft, lateral movement, persistence establishment, all the fun stuff. And then ultimately ended up encrypting the child domain, demonstrating kind of that what happens with sustained access. One of the reports, big hits, was how much living off the land technique was used in this intrusion. There really is a ton. But that's fun for from the side of like, hey, how can I take this and use this? It's really good. So some of the things that we're seeing here, some of the other details that we had here. So the transition from the Bumblebee infection to the Adaptic C2, it was roughly 5 hours after the initial compromise that Bumblebee deployed that Adaptic C2 payload, basically trying to act as or impersonating additional, you know, like Windows files, Windows address book executables, things like that. And then once Adaptic C2 was there, it became pretty much the primary interactive platform for the rest of the intrusion. Some of the things that we've seen within this, again, ton of living off the land activity, a lot of very extensive discovery pieces. We're seeing everything in this system info, hosting, who am I, NL test, all the stuff, ping, Q user, netstat, all the stuff is part of this. We also see the leveraging of the advanced IP scanner to really help in enumerating more. We're looking at Privest type attacks, right? Targeting the ncds.bit file, really pulling on the Active Directory credentials, a lot of usage around the RMM tools, right? So we see AnyDesk here. There's another tool called RustDesk. We see scheduled task creations, service creations. We see the your typical ransomware pieces near the back end. When Akira takes flight, you know, disabling Defender, deleting shadow copies, terminating the security and backup processes, and kind of like just doing its thing. There were, and I'm trying to find my number. I'm sorry, I lost it here. But there were, I feel like I was able, just through first read, I identified somewhere around like 12 to 15 type of behavioral hunts that could associate or that I could go after to target this. So, and really a big point why I brought it to the show, Scott, because I think it's one of the more, this is one of those reports that's like hyper fruitful for anyone that's hunting or trying to take intel and turn it into operations. But I'll take a breath, Scott. What did you think of this report?
Yeah, I mean, I love DFIR reports because of how thorough they are. And the fact that they don't just talk about the behaviors or techniques, but they kind of show you when it comes to data and even their notes on the data. There's a lot to be said in the screenshots and stuff they share. So it's just one of those things where if you're just curious what attacks look like and what do they look like from a defender's perspective, as well as from like the offensive purpose, great connective tissue there in the report. But yeah, the big thing, here is these reports also, you can see a lot of the lull bins and what they're using them for, how they're being used. What's great about this is you can even take some of these things and, they're not necessarily all harmful behaviors as far as like impact goes, but they're behaviors that let you do things. So you can practice and you run these in your environments and see if anything actually is detected and see what they look like from a data perspective in your environment. So it's a great way to try to figure out how to emulate some things and get kind of comfortable with some of that. But yeah, this, I mean, it's just a multitude of examples of things that we kind of always talk about. The one thing that I'm really curious about, and I kind of talked about this in the previous article where we talked about all the DLL loading and the image loading and how sometimes that can be kind of hard to analyze. They do a pretty good job of identifying here is the image load and this is what it looks like. And they kind of have the, I don't know what you call it, but the way the log usually looks like, it's whatever DLL plus, and it's like the offset that kind of, I think, points to the function or whatever being loaded from that DLL or part of that DLL. So I don't know if that's consistent on like every version of Windows or every single use of that same thing.
But I'm always interested, right, when we see those types of artifacts. So I've always wanted to really try to figure out how to dive into that. But in the past, when I've tried, it's not easy to try to validate all those things. But it is worth noting. It's an interesting artifact or note to kind of pay attention to, because you don't see that data available in a lot of reports, but they do put it here. But yeah, traditional attack. Interesting thing is the 44-hour mark. I would say that's pretty quick, especially based on the number of actions they did on the objective. Because they're pretty loud and proud. The other thing, I'll have to call it out, they do use a single character named executable, which is...
Way to go, Scott. Way
to go. I have to land on those because that's my like thing, right? So that's interesting, right? The mixed case string I think is interesting as well when they have like the CMD and the PowerShell with like upper and lower case mixed throughout. And that just calls out that some detection tools that these actors work against are not very hardened. For all attacks, they're like too specific, or they're not taking case into account. That's why a lot of times we always just focus on caseless specific things, unless there's a reason to be focused on case just for that reason. Because if someone just changes the case and gets around a tool, that's or a detection, that's pretty bad.
That's tough. That would be tough.
Yeah, and it's hard because like writing detections, you now have to add a lot more sometimes because depending on the tool, how you handle that can be very complicated or verbose, or it could just be a simple thing you just need to add, not used to. So, and then when you test, you're not testing those caveats, right? So there's some of that stuff that I thought was good to kind of call out and pay attention to, but not like diving into every single piece of this. Those are some of the key things to pay attention to that are a little unique, but to be honest, it's something worth just looking at, right? This whole report, it's a good thing to walk through. Even if you are seasoned, I always like to walk through these and say, out of here, is anything here I have not seen? And sometimes it's pretty cool when you see a really detailed report and you're like, you know what? Everything thus far in this report, I've seen a variation or a version of, and you're like, oh man, that at least knows that you've got valid experience under your belt, or you're looking at a lot of the right and reading a lot of the right stuff because you're able to say, hey, yeah, this is not new to me. So I would know if I saw this, why this could be bad or how this could be used. You know, it's kind of a great validation check too for the seasoned people.
Yeah. One of the things that I also noticed, like right in those lines, like there were tools, open source tools that were leveraged here, right? Like Adaptix. The Adaptix C2, I think that's open source. It's like it's a legitimately supposed, well, I think it's meant to be an open source tool that's geared towards adversarial, like post-exploit adversarial emulation. And it's just being leveraged here. There's like a credential dump tool called LSASE that was leveraged. Even the way they set up the reverse SSH tunnels, right? There were certain flags that weren't part of what we typically see as part of this process. So there was a lot of little nuanced things, even for me as an experienced hunter, that I got to, you know, go through and dig through. So just more evidence to your point there, Scott.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely worth checking out. But yeah, we were just going to leave it short with the two main articles to go with the quarterly, just to kind of keep the value add as far as hopefully seeing and learning new things, but also reflecting on what we've learned thus far this quarter. So I hope everyone enjoyed the things we had to talk about. I want to thank everyone for joining this episode of Out of the Woods Threat Hunting Podcast, and look forward to syncing back up next time. So with that closes out our quarterly, second quarterly, hunting headline report for the week of July 6th, 2026. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.